Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My next guest is Brandon Toms. He's the Director of Programs and Operations at the Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. Welcome, Brandon.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's kick off our conversation by getting to know you.
Yeah, so I'm born and raised in Southern Oregon, lived here my whole life, and really developed a passion early on for helping others and volunteering in my community, and traversed down a road of the financial industry career, and then really became unhappy with that and wanted to be more fulfilled, and went over to Habitat for Humanity after being a volunteer for many years. And I said, I'll give you 6 months to help you get some program things figured out and in place. And 10 years later, next month, I'm still there. So it's an incredible opportunity and a dream job to be able to do your passion and help others and make a living at the same time.
When you were a kid, did you ever dream that you'd grow up and build houses?
Never. Well, to be very transparent, they don't let me build houses, and for good reason, but to help people build their homes, it's it's a real incredible opportunity.
Well, tell me about your day-to-day job. What do you do?
So as the Director of Programs and Operations, I really get to do the best part of everything. We get to work in community, like we're here this morning talking about what we do and sharing the opportunity with Habitat for Humanity. And our main goal is helping people achieve the dream of homeownership. It's kind of branched off now with this repair because we realize how vital it is to help people retain their home ownership after they're able to achieve it. But we find families and share with them our opportunity, take them down the application process, which unfortunately, because we deal with lending and home purchasing, it's just rife with regulatory compliance type things. So helping them navigate that and making sure we're good stewards of that process. And then the fun begins, building houses and doing repair projects and celebrating those closings as people achieve the ultimate goal of home ownership.
So tell me about this critical home repair program.
We're so excited about this. We've been offering our repair program for quite a while on a very small scale because the funding just hasn't quite been there to support that. But thanks to some really large grants that we were able to secure, we have a big opportunity to help and make a much larger impact. The program is designed to help low-income households that are homeowners retain the critical health and safety of their property. So individuals that might not be able to do things like replace a leaking roof, or if their sewer line collapses, they really have no conduit to get that replaced and have it paid for. So we're excited for this opportunity to be able to give them a solution so that they can remain housed in their affordable home. And we know the benefits are incredible long term. So
we use these terms, low income, affordable. I don't know what that means. So when you say this critical repair program is for low income, what does that mean?
Yeah, thanks for asking, because I think a lot of times we can get carried away with our terms and especially abbreviations and acronyms. But low income is based off of a number that's released by the federal government every year. It's an AMI, the average median income for a household. And each of those numbers are broken down by county and then by how many people live in the household. So I'll give you an example. Like, our low-income spectrum for a two-person household is $21,000 on a minimum level, and then a maximum level, which is 80% of that federal median income, that average median income, $56,200, and that's a household of two. So that's between 40% or 30% for the repair program and 80% of that average median income. So we feel, and it's pretty much industry norm, that people in that window of income really do need some support in order to be able to navigate some of the expenses that come with home ownership or that wouldn't be available in the regular market to purchase in the traditional way home ownership as we know it.
Okay, so that's a two-person home. What if it's a four-person home?
Yeah, so it's scalable by the household, and all these are published on our website as well for more information. But so for a four-person, the minimum is $26,340. And $70,250 is the maximum.
Okay, and you're also celebrating Women Builders.
We're so excited. This is a great program that's been around for many years. And tomorrow at 6 o'clock, we have the kickoff orientation party. Traditionally, this program has between 30 and 50 participants every year. Mm-hmm. And our goal is to just break down the bias that construction is a male-dominated industry, we'll call it, and to empower women to feel comfortable and confident joining us on the job site. So we do classes for 1 month long. We do skills building classes to learn how to work safely on a job site, conquer power tools, read plans. It's really empowering and incredible. And tomorrow night we kick that off at 6 o'clock and begin that program.
Okay, so tomorrow it's March 27th. Mm-hmm. At 6 p.m.
Yes. And you can register on our website.
Where?
So it would be great if people would pre-register at roguevalleyhabitat.org. But it is at our administrative office, 2201 South Pacific Highway in Medford, which is right next door to everyone's favorite Restore.
Okay. My guest is Brandon Toms. He's the Director of Programs and Operations at the Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. So you're inviting women to come out tomorrow and just do what? And who can come?
Anyone can come. Whoever you are and identify as, you're more than welcome to join us tomorrow. The tomorrow is just full of information. We're going to tell you about what classes we have planned the next couple of weeks. We're going to tell you what your projects are going to be. We're going to tell you how you can take it a step further and do some fundraising and win some really cool incentive prizes. Really just an opportunity to come together to learn about what we've got planned, because it's just far too much information to blast out to someone on an email. And we'd rather give you some snacks and some beverages and get together and get some excitement going.
So these are women that have an interest in learning how to build a home?
Yeah, and hopefully with the ultimate idea that they want to become volunteers with us. We have about 10 women who have become regulars on our job site. We build a couple of times a week. And it was an incredible launching pad for them to feel comfortable and empowered. And now they're just as vital as anyone else helping us build our Habitat for Humanity homes.
So to become a volunteer, how much time do you have to commit?
You can come once a month, you can come once every 6 months, or you can come twice a week. It's incredibly flexible. And we're really transparent about what we're working on all the time. So if it's something you don't like if we're at the painting stage and you're not you don't enjoy painting, now's not the time. But when we're framing again and we begin our next build, maybe that's the time for you to jump in. And we do orientations every week, seeking volunteers, and you can register for those on our website as well. And we walk you through all the different ways you can support us in our work. And the biggest one, obviously, is on the job site, constructing our homes or helping us with our repair programs or building ramps. We have a pretty robust ramp program that's helping a lot of people be able to get safely in and out of their homes.
Okay, so that sounds like some of those critical repair jobs. Is that part of this as well?
So the ramp program is separate. It's run separate. It has different grant funding, but it's just as high in demand and just as necessary. We have a lot of individuals who have to rely on our first responders to get in and out and stay in their home far more than they need to, because they know of the burden it places on those first responders to come and help them. So this really gives them that dignity back and that freedom to safely navigate in and out of their homes. It's been a really incredible program and life-changing for many people.
Well, it sounds like it's a coordination challenge as well, orchestrating all of these volunteers who come and go. And yet you still have to build homes.
Yeah. And we're a small but mighty team. There's only 6 of us in our administrative office. Nicole, our volunteer manager, really is great at herding cats, but when we have a passion for what we do, an incredible, incredible giving and understanding volunteers, it just all comes together. We all put out the effort for the common goal of helping our neighbors in need, and we do it.
What's the average time it takes to build a home.
To build a home, we're at about 7 to 9 months. We usually do them two at a time. We do a zero lot line duplex style build. And sometimes the regulatory environment gets in the way. There's a lot to planning and receiving permits and approvals. And then when you add grant funding to the top of that, it can get a little dicey. But we try to hone it in as quick as we can to get these families in their homes.
Yeah, I want to dive into that a little later. But for now, I when I think of Habitat for Humanity, I think of Jimmy Carter.
Sure.
The most famous celebrity.
Blessed to have him.
Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
I did. I have had a chance to meet him, and I've had a chance to go to church with him. Him and his wife were incredible, and I think our organization is so lucky that he's hinged so much of his legacy on what we do and giving back and volunteerism. He was an incredible man.
And how would you say, as far as his impact, his importance to the organization, how would you describe that?
Yeah, I think it's instrumental. I wouldn't want to take away from what we do and accomplish saying we wouldn't be what we are today without him, but I truly believe we wouldn't be what we are today without him. We're just blessed that he invested so much in our mission and saw the goal and was able to shepherd us to what we are here today.
So building homes seems like a reasonable idea, right? Why is this so hard? Why can't we do this?
I think everyone thinks they have the right way to do it. And I'm sure every regulatory requirement is shrouded in well-meaning. Let's hope that to be the case. And sometimes when you're building affordably, you have to bring together the hardest of the hardest. So let's say we have a federal grant that we're working on that has some very strict environmental guidelines that we have to follow. But yet when we're working on an affordable housing budget, sometimes I have to buy property that may not be the most beautiful quarter acre lot to build on. And I have to figure out how can I buy affordably in an area that might not be the highest demand, but still doesn't have maybe some noise pollution from a nearby highway or a nearby railway or close to a waterway. And making all those come together and still hold the ability to build affordably can be extremely challenging for us. Not to bring in the whole profits aside thing, which certainly impacts our housing costs here. And I understand it's not cheap to build houses and we need skilled labor to do so. But it's a culmination of many different forces that make our job challenging, and it's gotten much harder. And since I say PC post-COVID, it's doubled our cost to build. It's doubled.
So tariffs don't help.
Tariffs will not help.
So I've seen these high-tech homes on the internet in Asian countries where they're beautifully done and they priced about the cost of a car. How are they able to do that? And why can't we just buy a bunch of those and put them wherever we want?
Yeah. Again, I think it comes back to regulatory reasons. I'm certainly not an expert on international build practice, but a lot of those things don't translate to what our regulatory environment says we need to have here. I think they're making incredible pushes to do so, and unfortunately, we don't have the luxury to be the guinea pig in that situation with the stewards of the money we receive. So we're letting people figure that out, and we do adopt some of those practices, maybe using some new engineered materials. But some of those also have to shake out their cost as well. We were just talking yesterday. The first homes we put solar on about 15 years ago, it was incredibly expensive. Now that technology has caught up, it's put us in a position where we can do so more affordably. So that's a good news on the horizon.
Okay. Well, we need to take a quick break. My guest is Brandon Toms. He's the Director of Programs and Operations at the Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Brandon Toms. He's the Director of Programs and Operations at the Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. Brandon, how long have you been there?
It'll be 10 years next month.
Okay. So before the break, we were talking about regulatory constraints. Can you give me some examples of what are these constraints?
Yeah. So as we experience things as a culture, we enact rules and policies in place to hopefully minimize the impact as they happen again. I'll give you an example. As we have recovered from the Almeda fire, many things have required a more fire-hardened or fire-resistant practice in building. And while those are wonderful and have a deep benefit for the longevity and safety of our homes, many of them come at an additional cost. And when you're building affordably and your margins for affordability are so razor fine, any additional elevation in what we're able to build, I shouldn't use elevation, we're not going stories up, but any addition or requirement to what we're building adds a cost. And when we have a family that's on the 40% AMI level where they don't really have the room to absorb any more of a cost, it's hard for me to find a place to put it in the budget. But when it's a regulatory requirement, I don't have a choice. So it just takes more of the grant and donation fundings away and puts a burden on our ability on a volume level with how many homes we're able to build with the funding that we have.
Okay, really quick. AMI will remind our audience.
Average median income.
Average median income. Mm-hmm. So how long does it take to build a home?
About 7 to 9 months for us. And again, we do them in tandem.
Okay. When you say you do them in tandem, are we talking two-bedroom, two-bath, or three-bedroom, two-bath? I mean, what's the size of the home and how many bedrooms and baths?
So it varies. Again, like we talked about last segment, we work really hard to maximize what we have. So sometimes we get a lot where we have to be very creative, and shout out to all those planners and engineers and architects that help us pro bono figure out what we're doing and build, maximize what we have. But sometimes it's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath with an attached 2-bedroom, 1-bath. Sometimes it's a 3-2, 3-2. We work very hard to do zero lot line style building, which means that there actually is a lot line in two separate identified parcels. Because when we get into things like condo associations and an association in general, again, there's an added cost to that. And to avoid that and minimize taking away from the affordability, we really, really love the zero lot line style. There's things coming down the pipe. Land trusts are a hot thing now. They've been around for quite a long time.
Say that again.
Land trusts.
Land trusts.
Yeah. So we have some builds happening throughout the valley that are working on a land trust model, which is where the property underneath the home is retained in ownership by a nonprofit association or an entity that maintains its affordability. So if you purchase a home and you want to sell it in 20 years, you sell it to the highest buyer. Mm-hmm. And when you purchase affordably, and one way is through a land trust, they restrict who you can sell that to so that it can remain an affordable housing unit. We know that the trajectory at which the value is increasing on properties far outpaces what we can build. So it costs so much to bring an affordable housing unit online that we need to protect that, and we need to make sure that we can hopefully find a happy medium between these low-income families purchasing a home and building wealth, one of the incredible values in home ownership, and still keep it affordable so that we can preserve that unit that we invested in.
So when a family moves in, well, let me back up. When you build these units, do you already have a family in mind, or are you building for a family that has already applied and
Yeah, most often we build for what the family needs.
Okay.
So we select a family based on their need, and then we find our project that's going to fit that family. A lot of times, it just makes sense to build a three-bedroom, two-bath for value's sake and resale. And so we may have a situation where we're overbuilding a small amount, but again, it's the wisest thing to do from an investment standpoint and a value standpoint. But we truly do try to build to accommodate the needs of the family.
I find it hard to believe you can overbuild. We have such an enormous need for housing in this region. Do you have any data on what that looks like?
We're hundreds of thousands units short. And
did you say hundreds of thousands of units short?
Yeah, for affordable housing. Whether that's accommodated through rental or home ownership, that number is just focusing on the units that need to come online in order to be able to accommodate those affordable, those low-income households.
Okay, so if you could wave a magic wand and you could have all the housing you needed here, how many would that be?
I don't know that number specifically.
Okay.
It's far too many, and I would love the opportunity to do that. So if someone has the magic checkbook that can go along with my magic wand, let's talk.
Okay. My guest is Brandon Toms. He's the Director of Programs and Operations at the Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. So walk me through this permitting process for building a home and the process for purchasing a home.
So the permitting process and the planning process really is quite cumbersome in that there's so many different departments that you have to talk to and really coalesce in order to be able to get that approval. And again, we coalesce while we're trying to find the least expensive way to accomplish what they're asking us to do. We know that the volume at which we need to build and the scarce availability of land requires us to be more of a developer of neighborhoods. So parcels of at least an acre where we have to do some public improvement, like put in streets and sidewalk and not just stub utilities to the street like we used to do for years. So with that, you have public works and stormwater retention and all these different things that are very expensive and very precise, but necessary, I understand. And so trying to do those while navigating, again, being a nonprofit and doing it affordably is a big challenge for us. Again, we're supported by some incredibly kind and community-minded professionals that help us navigate this.
So you have a pretty big network.
We do, thank goodness. Yeah, we lean on them pretty hard sometimes.
Who are some of those? Is United Way others?
No, they're just private individuals. Amy Gunter, she's an incredible planner, does a lot of work in Ashland, and really is vital to so many of our current projects. John Fields is an incredible resource for us as we navigate this process. Steve Ennis has been a wonderful partner. Ray Kessler has been a great partner. All these professional people that have a heart for what we're doing that make it happen.
It sounds kind of strange for me because if we're thinking about people who meet the low-income standard, they really don't have any idea of all of this minutia that's necessary in order to get a house built for them. And that's just on the planning and the zoning and getting through all the policy and getting the materials and all the stuff. And then finally getting it built, orchestrating your army of volunteers. But they have to purchase that home. Tell me about all of the various different organizations and associations that are involved in the purchase of a home.
Yeah. So it's our secret sauce, and it's a tried and true recipe. And most of our structures for closing happen this way. When a family is brought into our program, we work very hard to propel them into a place of preparedness. Many of them are perpetual renters for generations, first-time home purchasers. So we give them 10 courses of education to really get them honed in and prepared. Then we build and they work along on the job site and do sweat equity. And then we get to the closing process. And while a land trust protects affordability in some way, we don't utilize the land trust model yet. We use a two deed of trust system, so a double loan system. The first loan is for the cost of construction, and that total monthly payment is no more than 30% of their gross tax monthly income. So before taxes, 30% of their monthly income is the maximum for that first mortgage payment. And it includes property taxes and it includes homeowners insurance. So again, we're talking those razor thin margins.
You said the first mortgage.
Correct.
What does that mean, the first?
So the first mortgage is the only one we recapture that we get a repayment on. Mm-hmm. So it's their primary mortgage. Each Habitat home has a second mortgage. And the second mortgage is the difference between their first mortgage, what they're going to pay us back, and the appraised value. The reason we put that in place is to protect both them and us, that they can't just sell it 2 years later and then cash in on the equity, and then we lose that affordable housing unit. So that sits there. It charges no interest. By the way, our first mortgage that's a Habitat-funded mortgage is 0% as well. We charge them no interest. And then at the end of 30 years, that second mortgage, when they've paid off their first mortgage, is forgiven.
Oh, okay.
And then there's some other things in
so
there.
It's like kind of an insurance?
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay. So how many different people are involved in that process? I mean, you just talked about the mortgage. So that's you got a lender.
So we're the lender. We really do it all. It's pretty incredible what we do. We're the lender. We're the funder.
Okay.
Sometimes we work with outside grant organizations, OHCS or the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they have some requirements that have to be baked into that closing process as well. But for the most part, a lot of our foundations and private and corporate givers just say, you know what you're doing and your program is tried and true. Here's the funds. Use them to build. And they know that we have a way to keep it affordable that's fair to the family. And so
you're a one-stop shop.
We're a one-stop shop.
And how many homes have you built so far?
Yeah, we just closed on our 84th home. We just closed on two right here in beautiful Ashland. And those families moved in, and we're getting ready to close on one probably next month in Medford.
Okay, where are these homes located, and what's your goal?
So the two we just finished are in the Beach Creek subdivision off of Mountain. We're actually getting ready to start tomorrow moving dirt for four more homes off of Williamson and Ashland. And then our biggest thing, we're investing right now about $500,000 in infrastructure to do a 12-unit development off of Grandview in East Medford. So we're just finished accepting applications, looking for those families to partner with that project. And we're so excited that dirt is moving and we're getting ready to start swinging hammers.
Okay, well, we have about 30 seconds left. So let's revisit real quick the Critical Home Repair Program and the Women Build Celebration. Tell me.
Yeah, Critical Home Repair. If you are a low-income household with health and safety repairs that are needed for you to remain in your home, please let us know. We have an incredible opportunity to help you remain housed safely and affordably. Women Build, get ladies out there, feel comfortable and confident. Join us tomorrow, Thursday at 6 p.m. to learn about our program and register to take classes with us and work on some fun projects.
You say fun projects. This is home building, right?
Not quite. We're going to start on a smaller scale, but that's a surprise. But at the end, you're more that we hope you join us in building homes.
Okay. So last question. Just real quick, tell me about some of the partnerships you have.
With local, we partner with Access for some of our HUD-required counseling. We work incredibly with many different organizations that make up our nonprofit community and help our families in need.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have. Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you.
My guest was Brandon Toms. He's the Director of Programs and Operations at the Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity.